The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to an Ancient Fair Magazine podcast. Tonight I'm in the company of one snoring dog, Mark McCaffrey, Mike Cole, Lindsay Powell.
I was about to say, where's the comma there, man? That's the Oxford. That's an advert for the Oxford comma. Absolutely.
Mark DeSantis, and I think I've had everybody now. My name is Jos Poort. I'm the editor of Ancient Warfare Magazine. And today we're going to try and talk about the Greco-Persian Wars. If we can manage to do that without all laughing all the time. I'm sorry. It's a very serious topic, clearly, but let's just start with a question and see where we go. Michael on Facebook asked, what did the Persians record in their histories about the conflict? Murray, can you help us there?
Very little is the bottom line of that one. The interesting thing from the Persian perspective, and obviously the way that the Persian wars have been pitched in Western historiography is problematically always been East versus West. Probably the Persians were a massive empire stretching from the coast of Ionia in modern-day Turkey all the way to the Hindu Kush in modern-day India, you know, from the north, from Armenia down to Egypt. So it's a vast empire. Mainland Greece is a very small addition to that empire on its western fringe. So the moment of failure, as it was in the Persian Wars, the Greco-Persian Wars, to add that to the Persian Empire is not a massive failing of the Persian Empire. So it barely mentions the setbacks that it suffered at either Marathon or Plataea and Salamis and Thermopylae. Well, Thermopylae actually wasn't even a setback. That's, again, the way that it's been pitched to us, was a glorious delay, when it's not, really. So in many ways, the Persian perspective is an argument from silence, which is always a problem anyway, but they don't mention it because for them it was nothing monumental. It was, the Persian Empire had not shrank. The loss in manpower to the Persians was something that she could quite quickly and easily replace. And there had been several expeditions that had met with disaster and fleets that had been sunk. And the nature of the Persian Empire was, well, we can simply replace those in a very, very short period of time. So very little is mentioned in the Persian sources, as far as we've discovered them, about what happened in 490 to 479 BC.
There is one mention in terms of not a Persian source, but Dio's say his name right.
Theocristosum.
Thank you. Anyway, there is one mention that he gives where he basically says, speaking to a Persian, and of course this is, some time after, because he's a much later source in terms of the classical period, he gives the account that, according to one of his Persian sources, the Persians referred to the whole incident at Marathon as the Greeks overblowing a small encounter by a bunch of Persian ships, which during a visit to the Cyclades islands, had a small detachment had been blown off course, run aground on the mainland Greece, been accosted by a couple of Greek forces, who then claimed a victory over what maybe was a dozen ships or so, and then subsequently they went off without many losses, rejoined the main fleet and sailed back across the Aegean Sea. So subsequently, we get this, from the Persian perspective, actually the Greeks were overblowing a little encounter, which, on the other hand, since we're getting most of our information from Herodotus anyway, and of course he wants to blow it up into this great, great east-west affair, you can sort of understand the Persians giving their account in such a way.
It sort of provides a very nice segue to another question that we got. Do you have any idea of, it's Abram's question on Patreon. I'm going to change it a little bit because he's asking for a very precise number. But do we have any idea of the effort that Persia went to compared to its resources?
This is a great question, and I would encourage Abrams and any other listeners to go right to Herodotus's ship list. The reason scholars call this the ship list is it's a section of the narrative, I think it's in Book 7, that it's an inventory of the infantry and cavalry in command of the Persian army. And they call it the ship list because Homer famously does this list of the ships in the Iliad. But Herodotus' ship list is a list of troops. And the reason that this list is helpful to your questioner's question is that it shows the far-flung nature of the Persian Empire. It talks about Ethiopians and what they're bringing. It talks about Arabians and what they're bringing. It talks about, Cesians and what they're bringing, what the Medes are bringing. And you see this diversity of equipment. You see this diversity of troops. And if you dig into where these people are coming from, you realize they're stretching from this vast, vast stretch of territory. And what it drives home is the disparate and diverse nature of the Persian Empire. We, in the modern age, we tend to think of ancient empires as these cohesive, centralized units. And it's not the case. Persia was, Achaemenid Persia at least, was a collection of satrapies where these individual satraps, sure, they owed fealty to the King of Kings, but they had a tremendous amount of autonomy and governed their own areas, pretty much as separate separate entities. And this is proven in the fact that you see Xerxes having to withdraw from Greece, not so much because he's being defeated in Greece, but because he has to keep his satraps loyal because they are so independent that they could potentially rebel. So the question is almost impossible to answer because basically you're asking, what portion of this vast sprawling space and all of these disparate peoples is sent over there. If we look at the figures of troops, I tend to align with scholars who are at the low end of the spectrum, that the force brought over, at least at Thermopylae, is around 100,000 or less. What percentage is that of this vast, vast, vast community? It's obviously a drop in the ocean, but it's kind of an impossible question to answer because to the extent to which the king can directly call and marshal those resources, that's in itself an incredibly complex question.
So Mike, I'm going to be devil's advocate here. So bearing in mind what Murray just said there about the fact that we really don't have much of a Persian source to be able to work with, how reliable is Herodotus? He's nicknamed Father of History, but he's also named the Father of Lies.
It's a very good point. He definitely has an agenda, and he definitely has an investment in blowing up, how big and how vast all of this is. So we definitely have to take it with a grain of salt. But I treat it the same way I treat Plutarch, or I treat Pausanias. Not Pausanias the king, Pausanias the travel writer. I always have to make that point. When we have really, really limited sources, what are you going to do? I'm not going to throw Herodotus out the window, right? This is the source that we have. And there are other things later on that back this up. We have Xenophon, depicting the diversity of the Persian army when, Agesilaus is campaigning over there to some extent. Granted, Pausanias is writing a lot later, but is saying similar things. Yeah, you take it with a grain of salt, but you still have to take it, in my opinion. But it's a good point.
Herodotus has 5 million men, which I think is more meant to be the overwhelming sense of a myriad that you can't possibly even comprehend. The other thing, of course, is the idea that Herodotus, even though people like to poke holes in him, is very exact to the point that, we get down to single digits of how many men are there. And yet when you have another source like Diodorus, who's supposedly following Ephorus, he has 200,000 troops. And that is still regarded as less reliable than Herodotus, even though Herodotus is not reliable. So it's a funny one when you've got these alternative sources for numbers in the battles. And modern historians have tended to reduce such numbers further and further and further. And again, that probably goes back to Dio Chrysostom saying, it was a blown off course, as opposed to it's a deliberate mission in Herodotus by the expelled Athenian tyrants, you know, Hippias, who's bringing a Persian expedition to Marathon, we're not told the Persian numbers. We're not told the Greek. We're not told the Athenian number. The number of 10,000 Athenians at Marathon has sort of become canon, but it's like, well, yes, but where does it? Who says 10,000? It's not actually anywhere. Certainly not in the accounts of the Battle of Marathon. So there's all sorts of surety and certainty around ancient numbers that it's very hard to actually find out where they come from, other than we don't agree with the numbers we're given.
I'm going to suggest that, for example, that Herodotus apparently, did he not actually spend time interviewing people who'd actually been at these different places? So to the extent that witnesses...
Well,
so
you know,
to the extent
children,
the witness,
the children,
okay.
The descendants...
So it's a bit like interviewing the grandchildren of World War II, Battle of Britain, sort of, you know, Battle of Midway. So there's a, maybe a bit of embellishment, but there's a nugget of truth in it somewhere.
We think that Herodotus is researching in the 460s and publishing 440s to 430s. So there are veterans who are still alive. There's also the idea, of course, that Cimon in the 460s is at the height of his powers in Athens. He's the son of Miltiades. So therefore, certainly in terms of Marathon, he's pitching that Marathon was Miltiades' glory. Callimachus dies at the battle, which is a massive advantage to that, of course. And so that kernel of truth is absolutely there, but there's no one around who's contradicting the idea that it's Miltiades' victory. That becomes canon. And then, you know, even in the Peloponnesian War, you've got these references within the Aristophanes and also Eupolis and others to the generation of Marathon. And it's in several of the choruses that the Marathonomachi, the men of Marathon, must still be around, and there must still be a memory of Athens's glory. And even into the Roman Empire, the greatest moment of Athens's glory is the Battle of Marathon, and they keep referring to it. And everything that Athens ever achieved flowed from its victory at Marathon. That's a very Athenian perspective, and I think it's something that Herodotus taps into, being from Halicarnassus, but he's writing for an Athenian audience more than any other sort of Greek community, I think.
Coming back to the numbers, there's also, I think, sort of a hint that he's got some sort of tradition going on in some of his numbers that, you know, the number 600 seems to be floated around a lot for a Persian fleet. So when you're talking about the earlier Mardonius campaign launched against the northern Aegean states, then you get a number thrown around of 600 ships. And likewise with the Scythian campaign, 600 ships, and 600 ships turn up to Marathon. So, you know, whether that's the go-to number that he has in mind, or maybe it's coming through from, you know, his cultural background, the number that indicates that large, like we would say, you know, thousands, his number is 600 as such. But it's an interesting one that comes up quite a bit in Herodotus.
I do want to defend Herodotus really quick because we're kind of knocking him around. He famously asserts that the east gate of Thermopylae is enclosed in marshes and is a swamp. And that was something that was roundly dismissed in the scholarship. And I think it was in 2010 or 2013, Konstantinos Vouvalidis, he's a professor at Aristotle University of Thessaloniki in physical geography, and he did electrical resistography on the site and did core samples and proved Herodotus is exactly right. That is what was happening on the shoreline there. That's a fairly recent publication. I wanted to float that out because...
There was a ship found in 2018 that proved that he was correct about the construction of ancient shipping. So I think probably Herodotus is right more often than he's been abused for. I mean, there's even an entire book about gold ants in the Himalayas that kind of prove, you know, the story in Herodotus. I think it's Marmosets that dig up alluvial gold when they dig their burrows. So there's all sorts of anecdotes which show that Herodotus is not necessarily as wrong as he's been held to be. And I think it's also, there's nothing malicious in Herodotus, unlike Plutarch's essay, that you know, he may be slightly gullible, and he may record, he does say, look, I don't believe this, or there's alternatives. So I think that Herodotus is incredibly entertaining, and he's also the best we've got. you know, you basically abuse him at your peril.
Historiographers tend to contrast him and Thucydides, and then you get to the point of, you know, Herodotus still sees the gods in many things, and Thucydides tries to go, no, there's rational reasons for this. It just fits the whole tradition. But, you know, as you say, he's very entertaining. He's great fun to read, and if you haven't yet, I would very much recommend it. He's available in many excellent translations.
I tend to think of him as being like a very early reporter.
That's what he is. He says, you know, it's what it means. It's the result of his investigations.
Yeah.
He doesn't consider himself a historian per se. It's the histories is
inquiries.
Yeah.
Can I suggest to the readers, there are two editions of translations of Herodotus. If you can't afford a book, just go, you know, Google Herodotus translation. You'll find free versions online. But if you feel like buying a book, the two editions I highly recommend. Tom Holland's translation with an introduction by Paul Partlidge is absolutely stupendous. And then, of course, I always plug the Landmark series.
Yes.
Because of the annotations and the illustrations make it really
Many maps. If you want to get an idea of what's going on, how it works, get the context, that can't be beat. To stay in the sort of sources arena a bit, we had a question from Christopher on Facebook. How come there's so few finds from the battlefields of Thermopylae and Plataea? It's been a long time.
But there are lots of great finds. I mean, Spyridon Marinatos's excavation of Thermopylae, you know, turned up some incredible stuff, and the locations of where it was found was amazing. The problem with Marinatos's excavations is that Marinatos was tight with, forgive me if I'm getting this wrong, Giorgos Papadopoulos, who was the head of the junta, the regime of colonels, which took over Greece in the 70s. Stop me if I'm wrong here. And
yeah,
I think
that's right.
Because he was so tight with that guy, people kind of don't want to like his work. And there's a lot of shade thrown Marinatos's way because of that political association. And there certainly are legitimate reasons to question his excavations, and we should question everything. But I do think that because of Marinatos's political affiliations, a lot of people don't, they approach it with a degree of passion, which maybe obscures some of his contributions to the field. That's just my read on it.
You're also talking about some of the most famous battle sites in the classical world, at which, you know, if you go back, we've already mentioned Pausanias as the travel writer who's, you know, mentioning about going to these sites to see them in the ancient world. And then, you know, from that point on, they are the focus of time and time again. I mean, if you go to Marathon and just talk about the mound of the Athenians, that, you know, for a long time identified as the mound of the Persian dead, probably between when it was first built, it then gets added to, I think in the 2nd century AD, it gets added to in terms of as a glorifying the dead of Athens in the past. It gets built up, and then by the modern era, it drops by about 5 meters, I think it is, or something. It's something ridiculous because of the amount of, you know, ground level around that building up, etc., plus a lot of erosion happening around there, plus the 17th century excavations that dig into it to find out stuff, plus the 19th century excavations. These places have had so much attention that over time that is going to have an effect on what, you know, a modern archaeological team is going to be able to go in and investigate.
Also keep in mind that Thermopylae is the site, you know, everybody knows about 480 BC. There's something like at least 16 battles fought there, ranging all the way up to World War II. And it's been fortified again and again throughout the medieval period, through into the modern age, all of that. Plus, it's an incredibly geologically active area. You have travertine deposits coming up from the hot springs. You have alluvial flow coming down off Kallidromos that is, you know, silting up the gulf, moving the shore. The shoreline is like a 2-hour walk from where it used to be in 480 BC. And in the Bronze Age, the pass was probably closed because the water went right up to the edge of the cliffs. And the graben and the wall of the – sorry, clearly physical geography of central Greece is a thing of mine, so sorry about all this. But my point is that there's a lot happening there. There's a lot of movement. It's a geologically active area to a greater degree, I think, than other places, and that has an impact on what can be found. Further, what did Marinatos find? He found the Phocian Wall. You know, he found you know, arrowheads and spearheads on the colonos, right? Like, so not only did he find really significant objects dating all the way back to the 5th century BC, but they're where Herodotus says they should be. It's interesting, my colleague, Dr. Michael Livingston, who writes with me and also writes for Medieval Warfare, has some great questions about Marinatus' excavations. Why are we just finding these, but no armor, but no bodies, you know, but no other stuff? And those are good questions that I can't answer. But the questioner's assertion that there is like a dearth of archaeological finds, at least at Thermopylae, I think that's just not accurate. And also, when you move to Plataea, heck, we have Pausanias's column, you know, in Istanbul with the name scratched off, just like they say, you know, that's pretty significant, I think.
Plus, I mean, John Colson wrote several articles in Ancient Warfare. And the first one, I think, he explained why we often don't find very much. You know, it's because anything that is valuable, you know, days after the battlefield, you get the victorious army, they strip the dead. Anything that's left after that, probably local farmers and people find stuff, they'll take it away. Anything that's valuable. There's, you know, how much inorganic material is there that survives 2,500 years in the ground to be found? Well, some. But a lot of it just is going to be picked up, taken away, reused, recycled, and a lot of it just, if there's anything left, anything made out of cloth or leather, good chance of just rotting away, gone.
Yeah. Well, just look at World War I battlefields in France. I mean, there's hardly anything of those left, and it's amazing that they find, you know, what they do. And that's after 100 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's, especially with Plataea, you know, it's farmland. It's been continuously cultivated for 2,500 years after the battle. What, you know, I think the idea that it's sitting there waiting to be discovered, and, you know, absolutely there have been finds that have been remarkable like that, where, you know, when they do excavate the mounds at Marathon, they still find skeletons in them and several other battle sites. So there are finds, but they're not going to just be found accidentally. And those that are were, as you say, Jasper, reused, taken, melted down, sold off.
Yeah, we have to remember that, especially for like Greek arms and armor, a very large portion of what we find is the stuff that was dedicated in temples by the Greeks themselves. So they took it along with them put it on the wall. And some of those walls survived. They, you know, built up a nice concentration for us to find later. But there's very little that's found in situ.
I mean, isn't most of the helmets that we found, they were dedicated at the shrine, and I'm going to say this wrong, Olympios, but the German school, the German school maintains, and they find pits of helmets because the whole temple was so full of new helmets. Yeah. They take the old helmets and throw them in a pit.
There's a post that does the rounds every now and then of the number of helmets in storage, which is just a huge floor-to-ceiling rack of helmets, and then the 9 varieties on display. You're like, there's 9 displayed and 7,000 in a store.
Yeah. And they're old style Corinthian helmets, or mostly. At least what you see in the photos. It's just, well, okay, so we talked about a little bit about what we know and how we know it. Let's start. There's several questions that talk about the situation before the Greco-Persian Wars and how they came about, and I can see we're going to easily talk 2 hours if we're not a little careful. Kristen on Facebook asked, what were the political situations between the major powers pre and post the wars, and how did this affect the larger Greek world? Did these changes create opportunities for shifts in power or for lower influence city-states to rise in prominence, and did they succeed in some ways in accomplishing their goals? Could somebody please summarize a book in 5 minutes?
If I could talk about the Ionian Revolt and how the Ionian Revolt, its place in the Greco-Persian Wars as the first of them, I think you could make the case, as well as how it brought about, you know, the later wars, what we think of the Greco-Persian Wars taking place in mainland Greece. The Ionian Revolt was the revolt of various Ionian Greek cities dotting the western coast of Asia Minor. It starts in 499 BC. It comes at the instigation of the tyrant of Miletus, that's Aristagoras, who also did it at the urging of his father-in-law, Histias, who was actually an advisor to the former tyrant of Miletus and an advisor to Darius. Good relations with Darius, but he wanted to get back to Miletus and leave Susa. So he advises Aristagoras to begin a revolt. Aristagoras is already way ahead of him. There's been a failed expedition against the city of Naxos in 500 BC that leaves Aristagoras deep in debt and thinking that somehow, because it failed, that he's going to be removed as the tyrant of Miletus by Darius I. And so he thinks, well, if I revolt, you know, sooner rather than later, and I can take Ionia with me, maybe, you know, I'll save myself. Initially, he's successful in getting the cities of Ionia to revolt. I think that they probably believed, they had to have known the vast power of the Persian Empire when aroused and mobilized. But they may have believed, because of the nature of siegecraft in, you know, roughly 500 BC, that they would have been able to hold out against Persian sieges, or else it was entirely, you know, quixotic venture, which is a strong point you can make too. Aristagoras may have believed, after the failure of his expedition against Naxos, that Naxos had resisted the might of a Persian expeditionary force for 4 months, that if you piled up enough food inside your city and you had stout enough walls, that siege craft at the time would not have been capable of taking your city. Whatever the case may be, it turns out that the Persians were able to take cities relatively effectively. I know that the city of Soli in Cyprus, it took 4 months, but it fell. Palaepaphilos, that fell too. And so one by one, the Persians start retaking cities. One point to make about the Ionian revolt, it was not a purely Greek revolt, and certainly not purely Ionian either. The Greeks of the Hellespont region also rebelled against the Persians, as well as the Carians, the non-Greek Carians of southwestern Asia Minor. So for roughly 5 years, so let's say 499, you know, extending into the 494 BC, the entire western coast of Asia Minor is in revolt against the great king. But despite various setbacks, the Persians, rolled over most of these places over time. Eventually, even Miletus fell to their forces. One of the crucial events of the Ionian Revolt, and it was the failure of the Greeks to stand together and, you know, their naval forces at the Battle of Lade in 494 BC. This was probably their last true chance to actually have any success of their revolt. Unlike what happens at Salamis and other Artemisium, other battles in Greece proper, at the Battle of Lade, Dionysius of Phocaea, it's a multinational force of all the various Ionian cities, bringing various contingents to the Confederation fleet. He tries to teach the other Greek Ionians how to properly engage in naval warfare. He tries to instill discipline, and the other Ionian Greeks do not take well to that, and there's more or less something of a strike. And what happens is that the Samians, who are part of the contingent, they look around and say, if the other Greeks are not taking this seriously, we better cut a deal with, you know, the Persians now. So they, when the battle actually starts, the Samians flee, the Greeks are defeated, and the Ionian Greeks are pretty much rolled up. So that's the Ionian Revolt, I think, I hope it's the nutshell. Yeah. Here's what the upshot of the Ionian Revolt is. Sardis is the satrapal capital of Lydia. So, and it contains, not only is it the capital, but it contains the Temple of Cybele, which is the mother goddess of Asia Minor. It is burned when the entire city of Sardis is burned by the Ionian Greeks when they sack the place. This causes Darius so much anger that he swears vengeance against the Athenians, and he instructs a servant, always remind me of the Greeks, that I have to take vengeance against them, and even swears that he's going to take vengeance against them. He takes out a bow and shoots into the arrow and swears, I will take vengeance against the Athenians. So, because of the Ionian Revolt, you now have the Persian war machine heading westward ultimately, and that's where they cross over into mainland Europe proper. They come down through the Balkans, and then that's where we get the Battle of Marathon, the battles of Thermopylae and Salamis, and all that other history that is better known to us has its origins in this Ionian revolt.
I want to add one thing, Mark, is that Darius's anger toward the Athenians is not strictly because of their participation in the burning of Sardis. It actually goes deeper than that. Is that what a lot of people forget is that Cleomenes the First of Sparta had attempted to take Athens by force and install his own tyrant. And, you know, he was liberating Athens from a tyrant, but he was actually installing, you know, Assagoras, his own tyrant. And he was kicked out of the city by a popular revolt. Well, and then he returned with an army, and that army melted the same way that in the Battle of Lade, the Samians fled. In this case, the Corinthians split, and then the rest of the army broke up. That's another story. But the point is that that Spartan pressure on Athens forced Athens to send earth and water to Darius, right? To seek Persia as an ally against this threat from Sparta. So when Athens burned Sardis, this wasn't just some random state across the ocean attacking Sardis. These were sworn subjects of the king of Persia betraying him. And that, as the genesis for Darius's rage, the shooting of the arrow, the having a slave remind him, people never remember that. Is that when you're really walking back the cat, this is an expression we use in the military, when you're walking back the cat to why that fury existed, you really have to look at Sparta's aggression under Cleomenes I against Athens, which I think is a point that not enough people make.
You've also got the whole, Persia was already looking, as you're saying, at Greece and at that western expansion and through Thrace into Macedon, up into the Scythian lands. That's already happening before you get to 500. And, of course, the Ionian Revolt is really, it's a kickback, a pushback by the Ionian states who have basically had, you know, a good status happening in terms of economic prosperity at this time. And they are profiting from being the middleman between Persia and the West. And, of course, as soon as Persia starts looking for expansion across that frontier, then they're going to lose their economic advantages here. So it's a pushback against the Persian expansion. And they were probably, you know, Mark was mentioning in terms of, you know, what was their, you know, were they realistically going to, you know, win against the might of Persia? Probably, you know, they're looking to sort of push back the real authority of Persia back beyond that frontier again so that they can retain that status as semi-autonomous vassal states. And of course that helps. They, you know, they're trying to not just have the focus on their rebellion, but they're also, they shift the focus to involving Cyprus, involving Byzantium, those other areas, so pushing back away from the Ionian coastline. And it works to a certain extent until those frontiers are again pushed back by the Persians, and eventually it fails. But I think that we've got to remember that economic goal that's there for the Ionian state.
Mm. I think there's also the tyranny of distance involved, that you look at not just the Ionian revolt, but the Egyptian revolt in 486, that at perceived moments of weakness within the Persian Empire, which is, you know, based thousands of kilometers away in Babylon and Susa, you're at the periphery of that empire. This is the perfect opportunity for you to break away and establish independence, and it's going to take a long time for the Persians to re-establish control. And the funny thing about both the Ionian Revolt and the Egyptian Satrapy Revolt is actually they reassert control very quickly, which should have been, you know, a warning. And so I think that there's that sort of idea as well, that on the edges of the empire, you have the best chance. And that repeats, you know, the expedition of Cyrus in 401 BC is the same idea, that he can raise an army in Lydia and march to take over his brother's empire almost undetected because he's so far away from the center of power.
this maybe requires some interpretation on our side.
Yeah, so I think this is a common thread in classicists now. We are really trying to undo this narrative. So the narrative of the Greco-Persian War, I think for most of recent scholarship, not very recent, has been this East versus West thing. And the movie 300 of the comic and the movie both really played on this. And I think it's a really destructive, a really misleading narrative, and it's one I feel very passionately about combating. I do not see this as a clash of cultures at all. I see the Greek and Persian culture through guest friendships, through commercial intercourse, through the whole West Coast of Asia Minor being Greek. These really are inextricably linked. This idea that this beleaguered West stood up against a tyrannical East.
He says cultural misunderstanding. So, I mean, maybe he is thinking of something else. Maybe he's thinking indeed of, could it be that could the Athenians, what you said, just going on what you said just now, could it be that the Athenians misunderstood the importance of earth and water, for instance?
Maybe. I certainly lack the depth of Achaemenid scholarship to really comment substantively on that, but something internally in me rebels against that. I think that Greek and Persian life was so integrated that I can't imagine that even in Athens they would so thoroughly misunderstand what that meant. I think that they made that vow out of expediency, and then they unmade it just as quickly when they thought it was to their advantage, which is something we see throughout Greek political life. But I do want to emphasize that integration. I think it's an exaggeration to say that the Greek and Persian worlds were, extremely linked.
I think the other thing that's happened, of course, is the idea of Greek independence, which is obviously anachronistic. And even though it comes in Herodotus, this idea of a league, and one of the articles in the issue is talking about, it's a bit of a ad hoc. There's no actual oath. They say oath, but there's no record in the way of other oaths later about the league, the Hellenic League. But the fact is that the Persians are as integrated in Greek life as Greeks on the western coast of Ionia. The Greek temples in Delphi, and they're full of Persian dedications. The number of Persian envoys who've ended up in all the Greek cities, we hear about the Spartan and the Athenian mistreatment of envoys, but the fact is that those envoys have been at every other Greek city. At the beginning of the Peloponnesian War, there are Persian envoys. There are Persian envoys everywhere, always. So I think this idea that the Greek culture was somehow unlinked from the major dominant feature of that part of the world in that period is wrong. And I think there's been a way of erasing Persian influence on Greek culture and interference in Greek culture for many years in scholarship. But the fact is that the Persians were all over Greece, and they were intermixed through Greek life for most of this period, and the idea of a Western Greece standing up to this Eastern tyrant is the wrong way of looking at it, and that therefore, to add further, the misunderstanding of Athenian and Greek behavior towards the Persians is inexcusable. There's no way they could have misunderstood what they were doing. They have been talking to Persian envoys, they've had Persian gold, they've had Persian dedications at their temples for many years. To misunderstand what that means is a very deliberate political stance.
So, Murray, does this come back to our friend Herodotus then, spinning a tale because he's writing a book that he wants readers for, and he's going to – that's his angle?
No, because it's all in Herodotus. Herodotus tells us all about the Persian dedications at Delphi.
Right, I know, but doesn't he frame it up as an East and West conflict? Isn't that like the first paragraph?
We can blame Homer for that, because the opening of Herodotus is all about this. All goes back to Homer. It's always Homer's fault. Which is not the same. It's a cultural idea as well. The idea of the Trojan War, you've got a Spartan queen being abducted by a Trojan prince. That that east-west, you know, and he, I think he even takes it further. He goes back to Europa, you know. So there's the idea culturally, and I think, you know, you do get the idea perpetuated beyond Herodotus, and you often see that the Greeks are represented by the spear and the Persians are the bow. But the reality is that every Persian soldier was armed with a spear. So the idea of arrow versus spear, which continues right through until the 5th century AD, isn't accurate. It's an easy takeaway, an easy throw out. Oh, this is east versus west.
So to reconcile these things, so Mike is telling us then that the essential truth, which is the ubiquity of the Persians, and really that the Greeks should have known this. But on the other hand, the storytellers are making it out to be something else. So the questioner is actually onto something. The narrators of the story build a cultural narrative.
In the issue, Sean Manning was making a good point, saying that we are quite used to reading articles and books and reports of empires dealing with asymmetric war, dealing with, you know, whatever you want to call it, the natives or, you know, unruly subjects, whatever. This is one example where we only have the report from the unruly subjects. They're trying to be, the empire is trying to castigate, and not the other way around. And that makes the perspective so completely different that that's hard for us to get used to, I think.
Well, I have only one thing to say. I fear the Greeks when bearing gifts, and I think
yeah. But I think the other thing is that, like we were saying at the start, these are inquiries. This is not some, you know, Ranke and von Rankov, you know, history with capital letters shouted to the world. This is, I've invented a literary genre. Look at this cool stuff I've found.
I do want to draw the questioner's attention to, there's a great Osprey campaign book on the Battle of Plataea. And in that, there is a central two-plate color illustration spread, which shows the Athenian archers. I can't remember the name of the Persian noble that they killed. Is it?
Macistius, yes, or Macistius, depending on how you say it.
And yep. And you see these, there's 400 Athenian archers that are present at the battle. I think it's the only time Greek archery is mentioned in the Greco-Persian, in the battles of the Greco-Persian wars. And you look at the artist reconstruction of what Athenian archers look like, and they look like sake. They are Scythians. Mm. Like the dress is exactly the same. The patterns are the same. The weapon is the same. Everything is the same. And it's this really, I don't know, bucket of cold water moment where you're like, oh, you know, this foreign barbarian culture is so integral to how these Athenians dress and arm themselves that it really helps you drive home that sense of integration. And I'd encourage you to take a look at that picture. It'll really help.
I think that's another one of these things that we get as culture, that, you know, the Greek warfare always looked down on the archer. And again, it goes back to Homer. But yet there are various figures in Homer's poems and in the Greek pantheon of gods who were archers. Archery is vital, and archery is practiced by all Greek cultures, but somehow there's this narrative that no, archery is bad, archery is cowardly. But the fact is that all Greek armies have archers. They continue to employ archers.
I don't fear the Greeks, but I do fear the clock ticking. And we're 45 minutes in, we've talked about the war, but not very much warfare itself, and I don't want to get accused that we don't talk about warfare on the podcast. And we have three questions. I'm going to sort of roll into one by Damien, Jake, and Paul on Facebook. And they're basically, you know, we're talking about the mercenaries on, and actually we've just sort of responded to one of them, because Damien wants to know, do we have accounts of Eastern mercenaries serving with the Greeks? Maybe not Easterners, but then certainly Northerners. We're talking about Greeks fighting on the Persian sides, Persians. How common would it be to find a Persian fighting on the Greek side? And what made the Greek hoplite citizen soldiers so superior to the Persian warrior? Or maybe we should say, or was he? This is a gimme, and we're going to have to, again, watch the time.
So I want to draw attention to a great scholar, Dr. Stephanie Craven. I've had the pleasure of reading her dissertation on the Cretan archer. One of the things that has been posited, and Roel, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Kleinendijk has a book or an article, rather, Neither the Something Nor the Weaker, which picks apart a lot of the arguments about Persian inferiority. But we do know that Persia did use archery, and we do have descriptions of Persian arrowheads, and we've found Persian arrowheads that are smaller and lighter, the reed shaft as opposed to a wood shaft, compared to comparative archery used by Cretans. And in fact, we have Xenophon talking about Cretan archers that are making the march home from the Battle of Canaxa, experimenting, being able to shoot farther with the lighter Persian arrows that they glean. So there is an argument that is made, at least in the confined space of Thermopylae, where you have a Phocian wall, a stone wall in front of you. You have thick aspis shields that are made of, you know, thick wood. You have bronze armor, and you have Persian arrows and an archery tradition that's used to fighting more lightly armored opponents in Asia Minor is less effective against that particular instance of defensive setup, both a combination of panoply and terrain. That is one I have heard, but that is not an argument for the overall superiority of the Greek hoplite to Persian Parsi. It is specific to that instance. And that is an argument that is disputed, but it's one I've heard made.
The relative superiority of the Greek hoplite, I think the Greek hoplite was extremely strong, and certainly Persians wanted to hire Greek mercenaries who fought as hoplites on understanding the quality of hoplites. They had a heavy infantry doctrine, very effective armor. Their discipline was very good, generally speaking. However, I don't think it was hoplites automatically defeated Persians. I think that's not how it actually worked. In fact, if we could go back to the Ionian Revolt, you had Ionian Greek hoplites who fought in the same manner as the hoplite armies of mainland Greece did, and they had a lot of trouble against the Persian army. And for example, at the Battle of Ephesus, when the Persians caught up to the retreating Ionian Greek army just outside of Ephesus, the Persians crushed the hoplite army. So I think you ought to keep in mind that this supposed superiority of the Greek hoplite, it is not one thing or the other. I think it was relative. I think that the hoplite, while very high quality, they did not automatically defeat Persians or other factors going into whether they won or lost the battle.
It's just it feels a bit rushed, because I'm sure we could talk about this more, and maybe we should see after we're done if we should have an impromptu extra episode in the middle. But I think there's a couple of questions sort of about after the war. We tend to think about the Greco-Persian wars ending in 479. Pavel Vaverka on Facebook adds, there are hints in Herodotus and possibly in other lesser known sources that the war continued after Plataea and Mycale.
And the war did continue until the defeat. Yeah. Mm. Keep going.
Someone could make the argument, and I think quite credibly, that the Greco-Persian War was in play from 490 BC, even before, all the way through till Alexander undid the empire. I mean, there were periods of peace, but there were periods of peace in the Peloponnesian War. There was ongoing hostilities between Greece across the Aegean Sea and Persia for the life of the empire.
And Persia interfering with money is also a way of waging war, of course.
Persia was projecting foreign policy they were a major force in Greek politics for its entire effort. You have that. I think I've said this before. You have that wonderful quote you brought up, Mani, of Agesilaus, because the Greeks started Persians started the Corinthian War in his rear to make him pull out of Asia Minor. And he says, I've been driven out of Persia by 10,000 archers, 10,000 archers being the archer that's stamped on the gold Darrick. but it's a great anecdote of, like, this is ages after the Greco-Persian War ended. He was just driven out of Asia Minor where he'd been campaigning against Persia. Like, it's, that war didn't stop. I think that's a kind of an arbitrary date that we stick to it to kind of help historians, break it off in bite-sized chunks so that we can analyze it.
If I could build on that point, the Greek alliance against the Persians did not end with the failure of Xerxes' expedition. The Greeks then went on the offensive. One of the things that happened was that the Spartans lost interest in leading the alliance. The Athenians took it over, and the Persians were at least for a time at the Battle of Eurymedon, in which the Greeks defeated the, which I want to say was 467 BC, the Persians retreated from the Aegean arena. And because of their retreat from the Aegean, the Athenians were able to turn that into their own playground, let's say. And they turned the alliance into what became the Athenian Empire, and with their tribute, they were able to bring about an expansion of their navy and beautify Athens. So the political effects of the Persian Wars is that it lasted long after the end of Xerxes' expedition. It saw the expansion of Greek influence over the Aegean, the creation of the Greek Empire, and ultimately it was the reason for the Peloponnesian War, because the Spartans and other Greeks were fed up with the Athenians. And the Persian retreat from the Aegean theater was not forever. It was temporary. They came back in the second half of the Peloponnesian War, when they finally had a Persian ally that they could actually fund to take on the Athenians. And it was ultimately Persian money that, you know, underwrote the defeat of the Athenians in 404.
That sort of gives me a chance to tack on one question that came on live. What would Alexander's endgame have been if he'd actually captured Darius alive, or at least not on the verge of death? What would he have done with him? That's a nice what if.
I think that he was aiming at a legitimate, you know, succession, that actually having the you know, former king hand over, or actually tie him in somehow to the family, and you know, there would be a legitimate succession in the eyes of the Persian Empire for him, make it easier. But on the other hand, the whole rebellion of the Eastern satrapies made it a very much more convenient transfer of power for him, because he became the legitimate act of vengeance for the overthrow of the Persian king. So subsequently, on the one hand, I think he was aiming at capturing Darius for a reason, but on the other hand, as things turned out, it probably turned out better than he had expected.
Yeah, I think capturing him would have legitimized his transfer of power, but as it happened, it didn't really matter, although it did mean he had to fight for longer. So
I think he would have had a very, very big drinking session.
He probably did that anyway.
But he wouldn't have burned down Persepolis. Yeah, he wouldn't have burned down Persepolis, and that would have been a wonderful thing, because we'd actually probably have it still preserved now, and it'd been beautiful to see.
Two more Macedonian-related questions. Was it true that some Greeks were exiled to Bactria before Alexander?
Yes, there's a couple of stories about obviously enemies of Persia being, or rebellious subjects of Persia being transported from one side of the empire to another. Miletus is the obvious focus on two occasions. On the one hand, you've got in the aftermath of the Ionian Revolt, you've got the Persians having threatened Miletus with the death and destruction of their population, which they followed through on after the capture of the city. There's a mention in Herodotus of some of the citizen men of Miletus being put to death, but others being taken to Darius and to be handed over and presented. But in the end, they weren't executed, but rather transplanted to a new settlement, I think on the banks of the what is today the Red Sea, and somewhere around the mouth of the River Tigris. So that's one example of Greeks being transplanted across the empire. The more famous one is the Brancidae, who were a group of a priesthood population outside of Miletus at the famous shrine of Didyma. And this incident takes place after the Persian Wars. After the main Persian War. Oh, I'm going to get in trouble here. How about we just say in 479, and I'll just leave it at that. I'm going to run into problems here. Anyway, Xerxes decides that he would like to take out this population of priests who have been causing so many problems around. They previously had run Didyma, and he, because they have attempted to hand over control of Didyma to the Persian regime and have run into problems with the local population there, Xerxes solves the problem by transplanting them, not a small way, all the way across to the what is today modern Afghanistan, or northern modern Afghanistan, I think I'm right in saying, up towards the Hindu Kush, basically. And, of course, this is where later on, when on his eastern campaigns, Alexander the Great comes across this group of Brancidae, who, of course, he finds living a totally Greek life, complete with grapevines, olives, and their own theatre, speaking their own dialect of Ionian Greek still. And, of course, when he comes across them, he is then accosted by the people of Miletus, who are in his own army, who state, these are the traitors who we need to take vengeance upon because they did such to our ancestors. So Alexander basically takes it on advice, has a night to think it over, and in the morning brutally massacres the lot of them. In his words, another part of the vengeance of the Greeks against the Persians from what they did many, many years ago. So another lovely story. But yes, they're the two most highlighted examples of the Persians transplanting Greek populations across from the Aegean in further into their empire.
And as you said before we started and went through the questions, you wrote an article about this in issue 8.2. So if you want to read more about it, there you go. Final question, and we're staying with Macedon. Do we have any information about Macedonia's forces during this time other than that they had been added to the ranks of Persian slaves?
It's debated whether they're actually added to the ranks of Persian slaves, and that sort of is left very hazy by Herodotus. By the time you're talking about the first Persian interventions in terms of, if we're saying 510 or around 500, we're talking about the reigns of Amyntas the First and Alexander the First. They seem to offer, going back to the old earth and water, the earth and water offerings are made to the Persians by the Macedonians. However, the Macedonians seem to be able to walk the tightrope of not quite absolutely Persian slaves, but more like a vassal state, or maybe even something like regional commander, under Persian advisement. You've got a wonderful little story that's kept on about Alexander I massacring a group of Persian envoys because they have the tenacity to demand that he brings out the women of the court for their entertainment during one visit. And having taken grievance with this, he then brings in a bunch of young Macedonian youths who in disguise murder the whole bunch of them, but yet he seems to be able to sort of cover this up, which leads many people to say actually it's just a Macedonian propaganda from later on. But it does seem to be the whole thing is, were they really under the thumb of Persia, or was this later on the Macedonians under Philip II and Alexander III, who, of course, are giving it a good spin later on? We can't really be sure.
Well, Alexander I gets away with being called a Philhellene, doesn't he, even though he's given earth and water to the Persians. He comes down and says, oh, you should move. Come on, get out of my territory. No, Tempe's a bad place to stand. So it's like, oh, that's good advice, because they'd be camping in your backyard, which you'd have to pay for. So he gets away with that, which is interesting propaganda. And I think the short answer to that question is, we think that the reforms to the Macedonian military occur under Philip II or his immediate predecessors. So therefore, at this time, Macedonians are cavalry and or light infantry, and that their reforms to create the Macedonian phalanx aren't until the 4th century BC.
It's also not the Macedonia of later on, because, of course, at this stage, you've only got the control of the lower the lower kingdoms of Macedon. You haven't got the highlands at this point really towing the line with the what is claiming to be the king of Macedon. So it's a much more smaller state that's dealing with Persia. So maybe they can go under the radar. Sorry, Mike.
I want to point out, too, that when we're crediting these military reforms that you were mentioning under Philip II and possibly predating him, we can't leave out Iphicrates, who's an Athenian, and Epaminondas and Pelopidas, who are Thebans, as major military innovators that have huge influence on how Macedon reforms its army. So I want to make sure, and that's a great point too, because we talked before about the integration, in that earlier question about Persia and Greece. This is certainly the integration between Macedon and its neighbors to the south.
Well, I think we did it. We only went just over an hour, I think. But we answered all the questions. We tried to. I hope you found that enjoyable. If you did, you can support us on Patreon, and Murray can tell us why.
Lovely segue, Jasper. If you support us on Patreon, it allows us to chat more often about your favorite topics of ancient warfare, but also you could get a subscription to the magazine, whether it be digital or even physical, depending on the level of patronage you wish to patronize us with. Oh, Patreon. So be a patron, and we'll see you all next time.
Thank you very much, all. Talk to you later.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye. Bye.
Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.